Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. With summer camps for pre-K through high school, offering skills in sports, music, and more. luther.edu/summer-camps.
Now, over 58,000 Americans died in the Vietnam War, and nearly 2,000 soldiers are still officially unaccounted for. For decades, the U.S. government has been working to identify the missing and return their remains to their family members. Advances in science and the persistence of military families have helped make the program more successful. Our next guest has observed just about every part of the process of bringing a soldier home, and her search took her to Bayfield, Wisconsin. Sarah Wagner is an associate professor of anthropology at George Washington University and the author of What Remains, Bringing America's Missing Home from the Vietnam War. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm very happy to be able to speak with you.
Well, in researching the stories you tell here, you spent a lot of time in Wisconsin in the Bayfield area, following the story in particular of Marine Lance Corporal Merlin Ray Allen. Can you talk about what led you to Wisconsin and his story?
Yeah. Well, it started back in 2012 as part of the research I was doing for this book, which is looking into the U.S. military's efforts to account for its missing in action from the Vietnam War. I had the honor and the privilege to be able to accompany a recovery team, so a U.S. military recovery team that was investigating, trying to find and dig a site of a helicopter crash. And so I took part in that recovery mission, and it was stretched about 28 days in total. We were base camping, so we were literally living in the jungle, and every day we would hike up about 20 minutes to the crash site, which was located on a fairly steep slope on the mountainside. And our task was to try and find five guys, the remains of five individuals who, you know, had been killed in that helicopter crash. And it took us until day nine before we actually found remains. And over the course of that month, we ended up recovering a total of seven teeth and a few tiny bits of bone. And out of those seven teeth, one was definitively correlated with Lance Corporal Merlin Ray Allen. And so, you know, I sort of followed from afar as the case wound its way through the laboratory, the identification process. And in 2013, his family was notified, and a survivor of the helicopter crash, who has essentially become a part of that family, flew out to Hawaii to the laboratory where the remains had been tested and analyzed. And he was, this is a man named Jeff Savakul, and he was able to escort the remains and essentially bring his best friend, Merle Allen, back to the Allen family. And that's, and, you know, following that case from being there as a part of the recovery team to later being able to talk with the family members, get to know some of the siblings, to work with the local community. There's a VFW post in a little town north of Bayfield called Red Cliff. Yeah, and so in tracing out this story, it just, you know, every time I went back to the community, I realized that there was not just Merlin Ray Allen's story to tell, but also that of another killed in action but body not recovered. That's Dwayne Soulier. And the Red Cliff VFW post is actually named after Dwayne. And so working with the Allen family and with some of the members of that VFW post, I began to understand, you know, how was this little town impacted by the Vietnam War, and what did homecoming, you know, a fallen hero come back to them mean? What does that mean to those who survived, the family, friends, classmates, so on and so forth? And in the case of Dwayne Soulier, that he has not yet been recovered. And how does his family and how do those veterans at the VFW post continue to honor him? So Wisconsin is just, you know, it's had this special place in this project. And it started, you know, way off in central Vietnam, but it brought me back to this, what I argue is, you know, a very special place, both in Bayfield and Red Cliff, and the community of people who, you know, hold on to this memory and you know, and try and help us recall the individual lives lost from their community in the Vietnam War.
That story illustrates the lengths and efforts we go to in the United States to find remains of lost military service people. And I think we kind of take it for granted that that's just what you do. But we're kind of unique, you write, in the United States. Not every country does this.
That's absolutely correct. The United States stands apart from other nations in its efforts to, and I think of it as a tradition, a national tradition that's evolved over time. I mean, one could argue that it began, and others have, that it began back with the Civil War. But it's this tradition whereby we insist upon and we labor and we have developed extraordinary forensic expertise in order to locate, so repatriate remains from those who died on foreign soil, bring them back home, and then to identify those remains individually. So that can enable not sort of this collective remembrance of nameless fallen, but rather these individual stories, these individual fallen who return to their families, and these local communities get to reclaim those lives and to care for those remains. And in many ways, you know, the stories of that life, both during the their military service and before, they kind of proliferate in that moment.
Talking to Sarah Wagner about her new book, What Remains? Bringing America's Missing Home from the Vietnam War. And in the popular consciousness, or at least I'll say in my consciousness, Vietnam was unique. We had a large percentage of service people who were lost and not identified there. But when you compare Vietnam in your book to some other wars that American service people have served in, how does Vietnam compare?
Yeah, so the numbers are much smaller. With World War II, we have something like 78,000 individual service members who are unaccounted for. Now, approximately 41,000 are carried as non-recoverable, meaning they may have been lost at sea. So that number we need to adjust just a little bit. Although that said, with you know, the changing expertise, including with underwater archaeology, you know, we may begin to think about new possibilities for recovering those. With the Korean War, it's about 7,800, 900, I may be a little off on that number. But with the Vietnam War, it's 1,587. So you can see the significant difference between those three different conflicts and their missing. So missing in action or killed in action, but body not recovered. I do want to juxtapose that for Vietnam itself, you have 300,000 individuals on the Vietnamese side who are carried as missing and are considered missing in action. So, I mean, one of the things when we look at all of these numbers in total, the message we can take away is war is extraordinarily destructive, and that, you know, nations and families and communities, they're affected by these losses, not just, you know, the months and weeks, but the years and decades afterwards.
How have changes in DNA technology changed the story when it comes to trying to recover war dead?
Yeah, that's actually how I began this process, or this particular book and the research behind it. I had been working in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and this is, you know, post-war Bosnia. They had a lot of missing persons, and DNA ended up being kind of the engine driving that entire recovery identification process. And interestingly, there were two geneticists who helped jumpstart that identification effort. And both of them had come from the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory. Both of them had had a hand in helping to identify the Vietnam War unknown soldier who had been buried. His remains had been buried right here in outside of D.C. in Arlington National Cemetery. And that moment when it turned out to be First Lieutenant Michael J. Blassie, when Blassie was identified, Secretary of Defense Cohen, he came forth and he said, William Cohen, he came forth and he said, it may be that we may not have other unknowns in future wars. And I think for me, that moment, it just was this game changer, both in signaling how far advances in forensic science were beginning to drive this process, and also the sort of expectations that we have about what DNA can achieve. And in many cases, it is an extraordinarily powerful tool that the forensic scientists can levy in order to identify, you know, some tiny scraps of bone. On the other hand, there's the flip side is that it does raise expectations. And for families for whom remains have not been recovered, or possibly remains which you know, even with that most cutting edge tool, it can't unlock and it can't reassociate a name to the set of remains. That there can be a little bit of a jarring sense between our expectations and even, you know, the most powerful of forensic tools and what it's able to achieve.
You tell a story of science and of politics when it comes to bringing back remains of American service members. But more deeply, you're telling a story about ritual. What did you discover about American culture in researching this process?
Well, I mean, on some level, I try and suggest that, you know, the science itself helps to create new forms of meaning making and new forms of ritual. But I also was intrigued by how families, how communities, how, you know, the missing in action, they themselves ended up producing different kinds of rituals. So, for example, we might think of the POW MIA flag, right? Well, that's that, you know, the symbol that most of us, when we see it, we recognize it. And we know that that's a call out to those service members who did not come home. Or we can take the missing man table. This is the ceremonial table that's often it's used at, you know, everything from VFW posts to on Memorial Day at functions to help people remember. And there's a poem that goes with it, and it's you know, highly symbolic to try and invite us to recall what does it mean again to not come home, and how do service members, especially veterans of the Vietnam War, how do they honor that? And then finally, and this is, you know, as an anthropologist, I'm interested in what this means to families and how families generate their own forms of ritual, whether it's here in D.C. at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial at the Wall, a ritual return and leaving of objects that families do on a regular basis, or are they rituals of remembrance in Red Cliff at the VFW post? In April of 2017, the Sewellier family, this is Dwayne Sewellier, who's killed in action, body not recovered, that family invited the community to come to the post and on one day to remember his life. He comes from a Native American family. It's the Red Cliff Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa, and sort of intermingled in military ritual and, you know, the local family remembering their lost brother and uncle and so on. There were also some tribal traditions. And so I just being present for that and seeing how that process, even though he had not come home, they were sort of forging and melding their own traditions in order to help us remember his life, who he was to them.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're so welcome. Thank you very much.
That's Sarah Wagner, Associate Professor of Anthropology at George Washington University. She joined us to talk about her new book. It's called What Remains: Bringing America's Missing Home from the Vietnam War.